This Global IQ Minute with Jim Falk features a conversation with Tim Naftali, National Security Fellow of the New America Foundation, whose recent visit to Dallas-Fort Worth was made possible by the World Affairs Councils of America through a grant provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. Our brief conversation addresses how lessons learned from the Cuban Missile Crisis might offer a roadmap for our negotiation with Iran.
Thank you so much for joining us. Tim, your book on the Cuban Missile Crisis, called One Hell of a Gamble, The Secret History of the Cuban Missile Crisis, was published in 1997. What do you know now that you didn't know when you wrote this book?
When Alexander Prosenko and I wrote One Hell of a Gamble in 1997, we had access to some but not all of the Presidium or Politburo minutes from the Cuban Missile Crisis period. When we came back to the issue again in 2006, as part of our book, Khrushchev's Cold War, we'd learned a lot about the extent to which Khrushchev was a risk-taker. The anger and concern and feelings of insecurity that led to his decision to put missiles in Cuba was not as clear to us in 1997 as it would be in 2006. Khrushchev made a strategic decision in 1962 to put pressure on the peripheries of what he considered to be the American Empire as a way of containing American power, and it didn't work. And he was looking for a fast way of leveling the playing field in international politics, and putting missiles in Cuba was the way to do that. It's much clearer. His thinking, his motives are much clearer now than they were when we wrote One Hell of a Gamble.
In your remarks this evening, you spoke about the unique, special relationship between President Kennedy and his brother, Robert. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
After the Bay of Pigs, President Kennedy lost a lot of trust in his administration. He lost trust in the leadership of the U.S. military and the leadership of the U.S. intelligence community. He really turned to the one person that he could trust, he felt, in his inner circle, and that was Robert Kennedy, his brother and the Attorney General of the United States. And the two of them began thinking about how to get out of the hole that Kennedy had dug for himself because of the Bay of Pigs. And he used his brother to establish a secret back channel to Moscow that even Kennedy's National Security Advisor, George Bundy, and his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, and his Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, didn't know about. So that showed the level of trust between the brothers and the extent to which Kennedy had doubts about his inner national security team.
One really can't imagine today a president having his brother as attorney general either.
Well, one can't imagine today a president actually running foreign policy out of the White House through his brother to the extent that Kennedy did it in 1961 when he started this back channel.
What's the big takeaway lesson from the Cuban Missile Crisis that can be applied today to what's occurring now with Iran?
If you tell states that they cannot do something, be prepared that they might do it, and know that you have to make good on your threats. Because if you don't, you have invested American prestige and that of your presidency in a bluff, and the consequences for American world leadership would be enormous.
Should we try to open up a different door with Iran now?
I think that our rhetoric in this contest with Iran is ill-advised. I think we should be stressing our belief that Iran's regime is not a stable partner in the international system, and that it is not in the interests of any country for an unstable and extreme regime to have more power, whether it's nuclear power or any kind of power. It's just not in the interests of any peace-loving nations. I think that's should be the focal point of what we say to Tehran. When we talk about Iran not being allowed to have this or that, we are just inviting a nationalist revival or a nationalist response.
People rally around their
flag.
Well,
of course, and you're saying, and the Persian civilization is an old civilization, many glories, and we are actually putting ourselves in a position where we're at, where we look like we're saying Persians can't have something that Indians and Pakistanis and Frenchmen can have, which is nuclear weapons. And that's—I don't think it's a good proposition. I mean, it's this kind of approach that makes weak, unpopular regimes nationalist heroes.
You're in Dallas, of course, today, and every day people visit. Thousands of people visit the corner of Elm and Houston Streets where President Kennedy was assassinated now almost 50 years ago. And one of the many conspiracy theories is that Castro played some part in the assassination. Have you, with all of your research, ever identified any foundation for this theory?
Anybody who studies John Kennedy, President Kennedy, has to look carefully at the assassination. And I've tried to follow every single conspiracy theory from start to finish to see if it brings you to Dallas, to the Texas Book Depository. And they all have a flaw. And none of them explains that crime better than the single gunman Lee Harvey Oswald theory. There are some tidbits explored by Brian Littell in a recent book about Fidel Castro that indicate that the Cubans may have had a real discussion with Lee Harvey Oswald when he went to Mexico. It's always been a question. You know, what did he say to the Cubans? What did he say to the Soviets when he was in Mexico City? That's not the same thing as Cuba being behind the assassination at all. But there are still questions about what Lee Harvey Oswald told others about his intentions. I don't think there's any question that Lee Harvey Oswald did it, but how many other people had a sense that he was going to do it? That's still somewhat of an open question, but that's not the same thing as saying some states were conspiring to kill Kennedy.
And actively involved.
Yeah, that's a different kind
of. Before we conclude, tell us about your book that's going to be published next year.
Next year. Well, if not at the end of next year or early 2014. It's been 10 years since the last thoroughgoing look at Kennedy as president. And in those 10 years, all of Kennedy's tapes have been reviewed and released. There's some that have been withheld for national security, but very little. So we have an up-close view of the president that wasn't possible for an historian before. And in a sense, we're seeing more of Kennedy and his use of power than even Arthur Schlesinger and Ted Sorensen, the men who wrote the very first critical, I mean important, the first searching biographies of John Kennedy in the 1960s. So for my generation of historians, we have a chance to know more about him. I think since the Cold War has ended, we also have the opportunity to ask some questions about how he managed uncertainty in the international system. And I think readers are going to be struck by the extent to which Kennedy asked really searching questions and was willing to be skeptical of some of the sort of great assumptions of his era. I think Kennedy was more of a skeptic about the Cold War than people assumed. I think Kennedy was often alone among his advisors. He often rejected a lot of their advice. And he often had good reasons for it. I think he was a fascinating consumer of information, and people will enjoy watching the inner workings and playing out of his mind. I think Kennedy comes out much more interesting, much more complex, perhaps not a great president, but one that America was lucky to have at that time and in that place.
Well, we certainly look forward to reading it, and thank you again for being with us.
Jim, my pleasure. It's nice being here at the World Affairs Council.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.